speaker then.
Okay, Matt, come on up.
My name is Matt Snell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'd like to welcome the newcomers, and especially the ones that didn't identify themselves as being new, because I know there's at least one or two of you out there. And also congratulations to all the token takers. You know, there's a friend of mine, he tells me there's a little prayer we do before we speak, and it goes like this: God, please make me a hit. I know I only have about 35 minutes, so we're going to be trying to do this really quick. So I'm just going to start out with my favorite line out of the Big Book is actually the first sentence to the forward of the first edition, and it kind of goes like this. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show you precisely how... I got it right here, but... to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And the foreword to the 12 and 12 says, A's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And so I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, and I've become, you know, usefully whole. I kind of go like this when I start out. You know, 7 years ago, I was living in a jail cell. 9 years ago, I was living in the shrubberbs. If you don't know where the shrubberbs are, that's those bushes around the outside edge of a park, right? You know, I was hanging out there. I lived in those for about 3.5 years in a tent. And 20 years ago, I was assistant controller for a Fortune 100 company. And, you know, I have three college degrees. And, you know, when I was in high school, I qualified to be in the independent study seminar, which is for the extremely, quote unquote, gifted. And I don't know what I was gifted at, because back then all I ever wanted to do was drink and cocaine. You know, from my very earliest memory, I can remember sitting in my dad's lap and driving his car, helping him drive his car, with a six-pack in the passenger seat in a cooler, right? And me sipping on the beer, and I'm thinking like, yeah, when I get older, I want to be just like my dad. You know, and that's been the story of my whole life until I got to AA, is I always wanted to be like somebody else. I didn't want to be me. You know, and growing up, you know, I was a troublemaker. My first experience of getting in trouble, I was dared by some of the older kids to splash water on the patrol boy. And this was when I was in kindergarten. And they used to wear these little, you know, white slacks and stand out there, and the water was dirty, and I got dirty water on the patrol boy. And I can remember a few years back at one of my high school reunions, the gal saying, I remember when they took you to the office, we could hear you screaming as the principal paddled you. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of remember that too, right? And that was kind of how things went, you know? My dad, that was his method too, is he'd take a switch, and when I did something wrong, you know, I would, he'd put me on a chair facing the mirror in the bathroom so that I had to look into the mirror so I could see the switch coming as he hit me, right? Because when you do that, someone tenses up, right? And it leaves a much bigger welt. You know, so that's kind of, you know, I didn't want to be who I was. I was a troublemaker. My sister, one time we were in Yellowstone National Park, and I was about 8 years old, maybe seven, and I was really scared because there was bears outside, you know, and I was crying because I was a little kid, And I was crying because I wanted my mommy and my daddy. And my sister told me that, they're not your real parents. You were adopted. And I had no idea what that meant, but I just knew it wasn't good, right? And she says, oh, they don't love you. And I grew up believing that I wasn't loved, you know? So I was always acting out in school to get attention. And I started drinking and using other things at a very early age. My sister was six years older than me. And if I wanted to hang out with my sister when she was 14, I was 8, I had to do what she was doing. And that was drinking and smoking pot. You know, my first experience with LSD, I was 8 years old. And, I started doing cocaine on the regular at 14. You know, I played ball. I hit a couple home runs off a guy that's now in the Hall of Fame for pitching. He went to the same high school I did. Pitched a couple of he pitched a perfect game. And, I was, by the time I got to old enough to play high school ball, they didn't want me on the team because I had an attitude problem. You know, one of the coaches caught me getting high before a game, and that didn't go over too well. And so I was always having trouble. I didn't want to be who I was. I didn't feel good about me. I didn't like me. I wasn't good enough because my dad used to call me an asshole at the dinner table all the time, right? And, and he was my hero. Right? So I don't know if anybody can relate to that, that there's a parent that's beating you or mistreating you, and you love them, they're your hero, and they're doing all this stuff, and I just didn't feel good, right? I call that dysphoria. You know, it's the exact opposite of euphoria, right? When I just don't feel good. And, so I suffered from this state of dysphoria for a long time, and like I said, you know, I was young. I started doing drugs and alcohol. And when I started doing drugs and alcohol, guess what? When I was high, I didn't feel that way anymore. Right? And so, after first time I did it, it's like, okay, that felt good. I got sick and puked and all that stuff. And I just wanted to do it again because I forgot about all that stuff. You know, I've heard that so many times in AA meetings from so many people. They just didn't feel good, but when they drank or drugged, they'd feel fantastic. And so that was the story of my life. You know, I was never very good at relationships. My first experience with AA, I was like 15 years old. We had a coach that taught us drivers, health and safety and driver's ed. And he had someone come into the classroom and talk to us about alcohol and alcohol use. And this guy shared his story. I was sitting in that classroom going like, yeah, that's me. And I was 15 years old, and I already identified with this guy who was telling us he was an alcoholic. And, the first time I got sober was in January 21st, 1988, that's my first sobriety date. I got sober because my high school sweetheart, after 7 years, left. You know, she said no more. And I thought, oh, I'll just go to AA and everything else gets straightened out and she'll come back. And that wasn't the story. And, I got clean and sober for a couple years and things were going really, really good. They were going so good. I met the girl that was going to become ex-wife number one. And I stopped going to meetings. And it wasn't long after that. I started doing cocaine and smoking pot again. And that went on for quite a while. We got, that marriage lasted 2 years and 2 months and 2 days from the time we got married to the time we split up. After that, I spent 26 years trying to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Off and on, I'd come in and go out and come in and go out. And in that time, I You know, in that time, I've been arrested like 15 times in two states, both sides of the border, from everything from illegal lodging to possession with intent to sell. You know, and those are just some of the things that they tried to get me for. I was raided one time by five teams from the Narcotics Task Force. That's 25 guys dressed in, you know, police gear, the whole works, you know, coming in with M16s and all that stuff, raiding my house. And they came in and they're like, had a search warrant for trafficking. And they're like, how do you afford to live in this house? And I'm like, well, you know, this is my dad's house. You know, that's my dad up on the wall, Judge Snell. And their mouth dropped, and it's like, what? I'm like, yeah, you know. And anyway, that was just the start of the downfall. So after that marriage ended, you know, I was in and out, got married again, had a daughter. And that marriage lasted, from the time we got married till the time we split up, lasted 11 months. We split up on my daughter's first birthday. You know, at the time I was an auditor for the state of California, and I was still doing pretty well. So we split up, and then I became the assistant controller of a Fortune 100 company over in Arizona. And I lived there for about 6 years, and things were just going downhill. You know, I started drinking again after 13 years of not drinking, just doing cocaine on the sly. You know, I was doing, you know, just a lot of cocaine, but I wasn't drinking, you know, because I'm an alcoholic, right? So you know, just doing some of this other stuff once in a while was okay. I managed to go back to school and get, you know, finished 2 degrees. I was just doing cocaine, right? So I'm okay, and I really wasn't. I mentioned something. I used to get in a lot of trouble when I was a kid. A lot of trouble, right? And while everybody else was getting in trouble and getting arrested and going to jail and stuff like that, I was getting rides home. Because my dad was a judge, you know, and so I'd actually had been about 6 rides home for DUI until I told the cop that I didn't tell him who I was until they got me almost to jail, and they said, why didn't you tell me your dad was Judge Snell? I would have given you a ride home, and I said, that's precisely why I didn't tell you, you know, it's because I was more afraid of my dad then going to jail at that point. And, you know, that's just the way I was. I lived my life in fear of all these different things. And so going back to this, this second marriage, I have a daughter that I haven't seen in 17 years. I haven't seen her since she was 9 years old. She doesn't want anything to do with me. And I'm okay with that because it's not her fault. It's mine. And I've done the best I can to reconcile that. All I can do is go forward with that. It's about hope, you know. And so going back to this time, you know, in about 2000, I started drinking again. And it wasn't long after I started drinking again that it was like, yeah, you know, this is okay. I can drink. I just want to give up the cocaine now, right? And the neighbors did some of that other kind of white stuff, you know, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I hate that stuff, right? I hate everything to do with it. I hate the people that do it. I want nothing to do with it because I don't like tweakers and I don't like people to do that shit, right? And I said, but yeah, I hate it so much, I'll just do a little bit, you know, and that'll get me through those periods of time when I want to do that cocaine, right? And that experiment worked really, really well, you know. So I stopped doing cocaine and was just drinking, and I was just doing a little bit of this little methamphetamine stuff every once in a while because I didn't like it, you know. And then one day the guy next door said, well, why don't you try smoking a little bit, right? I'm like, okay. And man, that was like euphoria. Come to town. There was a solution to all my problems. I no longer sat inside, staring out the windows, not answering the door, drinking till I could, you know, because drinking and drinking. So, but that was the start of a 13-year downward spiral. You know, drinking with alcoholism infused with rocket fuel, right? You know, and so I got fired from that job as assistant controller, moved back to California, and got a job back with the state again. And I was making these three-way trips around from San Diego to Phoenix to L.A. where I was working. And when I'd go to Phoenix every other week to see my daughter, I would pick up some dry goods that, you know, the feds didn't really like a whole lot. And so they were kind of like tailing me. And that's when they came in and searched, raided me on a search warrant for accusing me of trafficking. And they came on a bad day for them. It was a good day for me because I didn't have anything in the house. And, you know, so once again, I got away with it. The truth of the matter was, I was trafficking at the time. And I lost the court case. They took my daughter away from me. I didn't have any parenting rights and all that. And, you know, the judge gave me the opportunity to get clean and sober, and I couldn't do it. Right? And I used to tell myself that I did it. I couldn't. It's like, you know, we were doing exchanges at the police department, right? And I was telling myself that I'm walking away from her because it's better for her that she doesn't see her mom and I fight, right? And that's the way I justified me not stopping or not getting help or not doing anything, because I didn't want to, you know? And there's consequences with that. So eventually what ends up happening is I'm living, you know, I get kicked out of my mom's house, and she passes away. I'm living in the bushes, you know, for 3.5 years, going through dumpsters to get aluminum cans and whatever else I could get to sell. I was donating plasma. I was getting general relief. I was getting food stamps, and I was living pretty good, I thought, you know. But I was pretty delusional from the drinking and the alcohol and the methamphetamine. And you know, about a month after my mom passed away, I found out, and the trustee got a hold of me and said, "Oh, we have some money for you, right?" So here's a guy that's been living in the streets for 3.5 years on nothing, and all of a sudden they come and say, "We got some money for you, right?" And there's nothing worse than giving a homeless guy a couple pockets full of money, right? And the first thing I did was I went out and bought a Mercedes-Benz and a big fat sack of dope and a you know, like a trunk full of alcohol, and went back to the park that I was living in, right? I went back to the park I'm living in because look at me now, everybody, right? You know, look at me now. It's like I got this car, and so I'm sitting in the car. One of my homeless buddies is sitting in the car with me, and the cops roll up, you know, and I'm sitting in this car. The cops roll up, and they're like, two homeless guys in a stolen Mercedes, you know, probable cause. And I'm like, hey, wait a minute, I'm not homeless. I'm blah, blah, blah. And he says, yeah, just get out of the car and put your hands, you know, all that stuff. And they searched the car. They found the dope, and they arrested me, and they charged me with possession with intent to sell. And that was like October 2nd, 2015. And for the next 10 months, I fought that case, went to trial twice. The first trial, I was not guilty, 10-2 not guilty. Second trial, they found me guilty, 12-0, right? I was offered deals. You know, we'll give you 90 days and a program, right? And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not guilty. You know, I'm not guilty. I never intended to sell any of that dope, right? So, you know, it's just possession. So I go through this for 10 months and convincing myself that, you know, it was just possession. It wasn't, you know, but, you know, of course, anybody ever asked me if I had any dope, I'd sell it to them, right? But I never intended to. So, you know, I mean, yeah, I was, at that point, I was like 13 years into a alcohol and meth run, right? And I was a mess. And, you know, here's what happened. You know, I go to court on July 18th, 2016 for sentencing. And, you know, I turned down that 90 days and that treatment program, right? 90 days is 45 days in county because it's halftime, right? And I traded that away for a 2-year prison term, you know? And I was fortunate. The judge could have given me probation 3 years. And I know today that she saved my life by sentencing me and remanding me into custody that day. And she sentenced me to 2 years in prison, one in, one out, all my time done at the state level, so I did it in county. So the 1 year in was 6 months. So already, right off the bat, you know, that 90 days and program, there's 6 months that, you know, that was a bad deal. Then I was out on MSO probation for a year. And that was pretty intense. But what happened when I went to that courtroom? See, this is, I know some of you are familiar with the old courtroom downtown, the one that they're tearing down, a part of tearing down that went for blocks, right? So my dad was in Department 15 for 22 years. He retired from that department. And my trial were in Department 14. And all my review hearings, when I came back from court, from jail to court and all that, were in Department 16. So when they remanded me into custody, they took me down the hallway past my dad's old office where I used to play when I was a kid. And that was the point where I got to this point where I call it incomprehensible demoralization, right? And I knew I was just like, this isn't happening. It was like this world's worst nightmare, you know. And that judge, she could have given me 3 years probation. And I'm thanking God that she didn't, because that judge that day saved my life. See, when I went through medical, my blood pressure was 220 over 114. And I had a spot on my lungs. And they immediately put me in a medical isolation cell and kept me there for 10 days until I could get stabilized and be released back in the general population. You know, and if she would put me on probation, I would never have stopped, and I would never have gotten the medical treatment I needed. You know, so she did me a favor. I hated that lady for so long. You know, it took me a while to get over that, right? I hated her. After 3 days of being in that medical isolation cell, you know, I knew about AA, right? I've been to AA. I knew about doing the steps. And I knew that I didn't want to have to go back to AA. That's why I stayed away for so long, was because humiliation, right? I didn't want to have to come back and say that, you know, here I am again, and that you guys were right and I was wrong. And I didn't want to have to do the fourth and the fifth step over again. Right, and for sure I didn't want to do steps 8 and 9, right? I didn't have a God, and I didn't believe in God anymore, because when I was like 19 years old, one of my best friends, his brother, his sister, and his father were killed in a plane crash on Christmas Eve, and we all went to church together, and that was when I stopped believing in God. You know, because if there was a God, they wouldn't do that kind of stuff to those kind of people, because they were good people. You would have done it to me, because I was a piece of shit. You know, so while I'm in that cell, I don't know what came over me, but I ended up on my knees saying, God, please help me. You know, and that was all I could do, you know, was God, please help me. And I knew that that meant that the next 6 months while I was locked up, I was going to have to do something different, right? And that I would have to go back to AA. You know, if I wanted to break this cycle, because I knew if I didn't do this, if I didn't get clean and sober, I would just keep going in and out of jail. Not in and out of getting loaded. Who cares about that? It's the in and out of getting jail, and I did not want to be there. You know, I'd rather be living in a tent in the suburbs at the park than living in jail. You know, I don't know anybody else, but that's me. And So what happened while I was in that, while I was locked up, one day they came through and they said, it was a Sunday, obviously, because you'll hear the rest of the story. They said, does anybody want to go to church? And I'm sitting there going like, yeah, you know, anything to get out of this cell for an hour, right? And I went to church, and, you know, for my whole life, I had no purpose. I was floating. I you know, I didn't believe in myself. I hated myself. I had no purpose. I don't know why so many of my friends were dying, and I was still alive. And someone said, "It's all because God has something in store for you. He wants to use you." I'm like, "Yeah, right. Whatever, right?" And so I'm sitting in church with this pastor, and he said something that day, and he said, "We all have but one purpose here on earth." You know, my ears perked up because I was looking for answers because I had none. And the answer he gave me was, and that's to know God. And I'm sitting there going like, yeah, I'm fucked, right? And, you know, I had found an AA book in the cell area where I was. And I'm like, yeah, how do we do that, right? I had no idea. I was like, yeah, how am I going to find this God, right? And I was reading out of We of the Agnostics. And I read this part on page 45. It said, our human resources as marshaled by the will were not sufficient. They failed utterly. A lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously. But where were and how were we to find this power? And the next line was the answer to that. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problems. You know, and I read that, and I started reading this book, I read the big book and the 12 and 12 like three times each while I was there. And I signed up to go to AA meetings, and I started doing the writing and all this stuff because I was doing it on my own, right? Because I was incarcerated because I didn't want to get loaded anymore. And, you know, there's these four guys that started that were bringing meetings to me when I was locked up. And, you know, they're from a meeting called Mount Soledad Men's. And that meeting meets at 9 o'clock on Saturday mornings. You know, they're bringing me meetings, and they gave me my books, and one of the guys gave me his phone number, and I called him, and he said he'd be my sponsor, and he said, give me a call when you get out of jail. And the first day I got out of jail, I gave him a call, and they said, you know, come to the meeting on Saturday. And that was January 21st of 2017. I've been going to that meeting almost every Saturday since then. And, you know, those four guys still go to that meeting. You know, I got a sponsor. I did the steps. I did what I was told to do. I started doing service work. You know, started going to the VOA to do H&I, service at meetings. Anyway, you know, and at that meeting, I found a core group of guys, and I started surfing with some of these guys a couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago. And so we get up every Saturday morning, and we meet between 6 and 6:30 at Scripps. and go surfing, you know. And I just learned how to surf at 58 years old. And you know, and you know, I have this group of guys that love me, you know, and I've never felt love before, right? I've had a group of guys and folks that I love, and I've never been able to love before, you know. And Joe's here tonight, and about a year and a half ago, you know, I was surfing on this old foam, you know, these foam boards you get at Costco, and Joe said, "Let's go surfing one day," and says, "I got a board for you." And he brought me a board and gave me a board. I've been surfing on that board for a year and a half now. And you know, I've been surfing 3 or 4 times a week. So I'm starting to, you know, I can surf a little bit now, you know. And I'm now the secretary of Mount Soledad Men's, you know, seven years later. And I get kind of emotional thinking about that stuff, right? And today, you know, yesterday Joe and I surfed. And today I was out there surfing I caught the best wave of my life today. You know, I it was a ride that was probably about 125 yards long. It was from like 2 houses south of the steps at Strips all the way up to the cafe, and it was just, it just kept peeling, and I'm just like, you know, and that's the way my life is going today. You know, and it's all because of, you know, following some instructions, right? I got a group of guys that I listen to. You know, they've checked me on my shit several times. Alfred does it regularly, and I appreciate him for doing that. And, you know, if it wasn't for men like that, I wouldn't be living the life that I'm living today. You know, and, I went back to school and became, to get certified, get to become a counselor. So I'm a counselor now. And about 4 months ago, I applied for a job, and you know, it was a job working at the prison, and it was kind of scary. And they offered me the job, and I didn't want to leave the job I was at because I really liked where I was working, right? And it was really scary because this is something I wanted to do, and I'm like, God, is this the right move or not? And I was having a lot of anxiety over this. And when I went to give notice to my boss, he said, "Oh, yeah, there's something I want to tell you, too." He says, "My last day is going to be on October 31st. And that was about 10 days from, you know, from when my last day was going to be. And I'm like, oh, God, right? And it was like, cool, because he's one of the reasons that I liked working there at that job, right? And then I went and talked to the lead counselor, because they picked someone to be the program manager there. And I'm like, God, why didn't they pick the lead counselor? She'd be the obvious person, right? And I went to her, and she says, "Oh, well, I'm leaving too." And it turns out that the program manager left, and the lead counselor and I left on the same day, right? It was our last day. And so, you know, if you don't believe that there's some kind of higher power or God working in your life, or that there's one out there, this is a perfect example of how this is, because, you know, that move from that job to that job, as scary as it was a move that was made by my higher power, right? All those things fell into place because of my higher power, you know, so I'm now working as a counselor at the prison. If they knew who I thought I was, they wouldn't be letting me out to go home every night. But evidently, I passed their background check somehow, you know. I don't know how, but I would like to say this, though, is about a year and a half ago, I applied for a restoration, right? So about a year and a half ago, I got a notice from the court saying that all my criminal activity has been not expunged, but burned. It was so. It's been discharged. So So what they did is they went back in, opened up all the cases, and they went in and sealed them all, and they discharged each and every one of them. So now if anybody goes and looks back at my criminal record, all they see is a bunch of stuff that was discharged, no convictions. And that's because, you know, doing the 12 steps, working the program, you know, being of service. And, yeah, I have a life today that is full of meaning and purpose. And, you know, I just want to read one little part out of this book that I really enjoy. It's the story on the it's a portion of Crossing the River Denial. And this lady, it's on page 336 and 337. I'm just going to read you a little bit from page 337. It says, I was never a joiner, but I got deeply involved in AA service because you told me if I did, I would never have to drink again. You said as long as I put AA first in my life, everything I put second would be first class. This has proved to be true over and over again. So I continue to put AA and God first, and everything I ever lost was returned many times over. The career that I lost had been restored with even greater success. The house that I'd lost has been replaced by a townhouse that is just the right size for me. So here I am, sober, successful, serene. Just a few of the gifts of the program for surrendering, suiting up, and showing up for life every day. Good days and bad days, reality is a wild ride, and I wouldn't miss it for the world. I don't question how this program works. I trust my God. I stay involved in AA service. I go to lots of meetings, work with others, and practice the principles of the steps to the best of my willingness each day. I don't know which one of these keeps me sober, and I'm not about to try to find out. It's worked for me for a few days now, so I think I'll try it again tomorrow. Thank you. That's all I got.
We thank Matt and hope he comes back to visit us soon. Let's give Matt a great hand. Thank you. We also like to thank the residents of the House and the Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner. Let's circle up to close with the Serenity Prayer.